to open up our hearts and open up our minds, Father, and learn about the world that we live in, Father, informed by the biblical history as you have provided to us, Father. We just thank you that we have your word that does give us so much insight into the ancient history of this world, Father, and we rely so heavily upon it, Father. We just take a moment to praise you and to glorify you, Father, lift you up, Father. We recognize you as the God of all creation. We ponder all the things that you have made for us, Father, the vastness of the cosmos, all the beautiful things here on this planet that we enjoy so much each and every day, Father. We just praise you and glorify you and honor you as the glorious God of all creation, Father. Father, just join us this evening, Father. Fill me with your spirit, Father. Fill these people. Give me the words to say. Help me to find the words. And Father, just fill these people with wisdom. Give us wisdom, Father. Wisdom to understand the world that we live in, Father. Wisdom to interpret information that we're taught. Filter that through the biblical worldview, Father. We just praise you and thank you. Jesus Christ, we are humble at your sacrifice, and we love and praise you, Father. In Christ's name, amen. All right. So we're going to talk about human evolution this evening. And my goal when in doing any of these kinds of things is to help people interpret scientific findings from the biblical worldview. This is something that we must do. We got to remember, keep in mind that what scientists are doing is, well, that many scientists today are atheists. They have rejected biblical history. They rejected the Bible. And they're doing their best to interpret our world through their worldview, a worldview of atheism, a worldview of naturalism, materialism. Scientists that take to this worldview, that hold to this worldview, aren't doing their best to interpret our world. But we must remember that what they are teaching us is their interpretation of scientific findings. If we want to know the true history of the world, we must interpret scientific findings ourselves, consistent with the biblical worldview. Where a lot of Christians fall prey is that they accept whatever it is scientists happen to be teaching right now, and then assume that's all fact, that that's all true, and then look to the Bible and figure out how they can twist Scripture around so it's not in conflict. There are conflicts between what scientists are teaching today and what the biblical Bible teaches. But if we want to know the truth, we must interpret scientific findings ourselves, consistent with the biblical worldview. Keep that in mind. Be skeptical about what you're being taught by a scientist who's an atheist, who's a naturalist. We live in a world with a supernatural history. God spoke the universe into existence, created this world just as it is now, mature. Adam, boom, fully mature, trees and plants and animals fully mature. You can't interpret a world like that through rigid philosophical naturalism. Remember that. This is what scientists are trying to do. They're trying to interpret our world, but it cannot be done. You cannot interpret a world like ours through rigid philosophical naturalism. So keep this in mind. As we go through this topic of human evolution, keep that in mind. This is an important subject. And this one right here, the fossil record as well had something to do with that, but this subject right here convinced a great many Christians that evolution must be true. When they saw what they considered to be credible evidence of human evolution presented, that was it. I mean, a lot of people can accept a degree of evolution, an amount of evolution. We recognize that God created the organisms that inhabit this planet with an ability to adapt. That's amazing. That animals change, plants and animals change through time to adapt to their surroundings in very remarkable and ways and very rapidly. So a degree of evolution has taken place. But many Christians ended up accepting evolution hook, line, and sinker, that all of evolution must be true if humans have evolved from apes, because that was the big holdout. They could accept evolution except for human evolution. We must be distinct. We must be different. But when they saw credible evidence of human evolution, that was it. They just accept evolution hook, line, and sinker. I mean, a lot of people were taught the names of these famous apes. I know the name Australopithecus afarensis from my dad, who either was impressed by that or thought saying the word was very impressive, you know, one or the other. But I know that from my dad. Many Christians were just very impressed by these findings and the significance of them. Human evolution is taught as absolute fact today in public schools. Absolute fact terminology is used. This quote comes from Prentice Hall Biology, which is the most widely used biology textbook used in public schools today, I think without question. A matter of fact, terminology, humans and other primates, they say, evolved from a common ancestor that lived more than 65 million years ago. Matter of fact, not that we think, it's not theoretical, it's matter of fact. Between 6 and 7 million years, the hominoid line gave rise to a branch that ultimately led to the ancestors and closest relatives of modern humans. Again, matter of fact terminology. They place humans right there along with all the other apes. We are taxonomically classified as a primate. We're a primate. That's how they consider us, that we're just another ape. But this is very different from the Bible, from what the Bible teaches, that we were made in the image of God. And, you know, Christians that accept evolution find themselves in some very kind of sticky waters with regard to this specific subject, especially with regard to Adam. You want to test a theistic evolutionist view, ask them, how do they regard Adam? Because Christians that accept evolution, what you would call a theistic evolutionist, either view Adam in one of two ways. Many take the view that God simply created Adam from an ape-like hominid. That once evolution had progressed enough, once these apes reached a level of development physically and cognitively, then he breathed the breath of life into some ancient hominid, then moved that new person into the Garden of Eden. And Bill Dembski even says, and then he must have given him amnesia of sorts so he wouldn't remember his formal animal life. You know, that's one of the ways that they view Adam. The other is just to view Adam as not a real person at all. That the entire story there in the Garden of Eden was just allegorical. Adam's name means man. And they say that was just a story to explain to us human nature and how we relate to God and these kind of things. The problem with that, though, is if Adam was not a real man, who was? When does the biblical history become true? If Adam was not a real man, who was the first real man? Well, you find yourself in some really, a really slippery slope there fast. But unfortunately, this is what a lot of Christians hold to. One of those two views, either God created Adam from an ape-like hominid or Adam was not a real man at all. Theistic evolutionists take one of the two perspectives, and you can challenge them on that because, like I say, if Adam was not a real man, who was? You know, when does the Bible become real? When can we start trusting the history in the Bible? Because the Bible is a history book. And it contains more history than any library of history books, especially regarding that early period of the earth. I mean, there's nothing that compares to the Bible, even about Egyptian history, the history of the Hittites, Amalekites, nothing, there's nowhere else to look for that history than in the Bible. It's a history book. Me, I just don't think we can reconcile these two at all. But a lot of Christians do, and they do this to their peril, I believe, and to the peril of the young people that they teach. Most of, you know, your Christian colleges today are like one of the most dangerous places for a young person to study almost. At least at secular schools, they know they're going to get taught an atheistic perspective. They go off to a Christian college assuming they're going to get biblical worldview taught to them, and what they ultimately get fed is a bunch of atheistic interpretation, scientific interpretations as well. They're going to be taught these views about Adam, that he was either God created him from an ancient hominid, or he didn't exist at all. These are what are the views that are being taught in our Christian colleges today. Check them. We can look to Jesus for some important quotes here. I just don't think we can reconcile these two views at all. Jesus says, this people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of man. That's what we do. We accept scientific teachings as absolute fact and teach these as doctrine. And it's kind of, and what's the, probably the most misfortunate aspect about it is people that take these views, people that hold to these views and teach them, often they know they're not really solid in that teaching, in that view. They know that that's one way of interpreting things. Their views on Adam, for example, whether or not he was a real man or not, they know that that's not a view that they held to before. That their views have changed over time, and that's kind of where they've settled now. So it's a view of theirs, but you know they don't take it as being just solid, absolute fact. But unfortunately, when they teach their view to some young people, that young person will take it as his absolute fact, even though the person teaching it doesn't consider it to be so. And that's why it's really, really dangerous, and some of these people can be as well. Christ himself gave to equip people for works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up. Then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming. We got to be careful. Got to be careful. Always stand firm with the biblical worldview. Interpret scientific findings yourselves. I encourage you. So I want to take you on a little tour of the whole human evolution spectrum here, as much as I can within the limited time that we have. But I got a lot of information for you. So if you didn't know how to interpret the ape-man perspective from the biblical worldview, this should help. What I try to do is to give a summary of what the creation scientists teach about a particular subject. And so I do my best to summarize this for you here. We'll start with some ancient history. Nebraska Man, shown here as illustrated in the London Times, illustrated London News. Nebraska Man was discovered in Nebraska in the year 1922. Look how much detail you get from Nebraska Man. But Nebraska Man wasn't found with a skull, wasn't found with a complete skeleton, or even a jawbone. None of these were found into Nebraska Man. Now, just so you know the historical significance, Nebraska Man was even used as evidence, presented as evidence in the Scopes trial, the trial that was put on by the American Civil Liberties Union to challenge the Butler Act, the teaching of human evolution in public schools. It was a big media circus trial that they put on, but it was used as evidence in the Scopes trial. So remember that as I explain what Nebraska Man really was. But look how much information they got about Nebraska Man, even though they didn't have a complete skeleton, a complete skull, a complete jawbone. They could tell what Nebraska Man looks like and also what his very fetching wife looks like there too, as well, apparently. But they didn't have any of these. What they did have was just a single molar tooth, a single tooth. That's actually a diagram from the original publication. All they found was a single molar tooth. And it took several years, 5 years exactly, for a full investigation to be done and for the findings to be published in Scientific American. And it turned out that Nebraska Man was neither an ape nor a man. Turned out that the tooth belonged to an extinct pig, a peccary of the genus Prothmops. It was an extinct pig.
I get, yeah.
But this is not an isolated incident. In 1983, a dolphin's rib was misinterpreted as a collarbone of a human, a dolphin's rib. Tim White, who's an anthropologist at the University of California, Berkeley, criticized the claim, calling it Flipperpithecus. Flipperpithecus. He says a 5-million-year-old piece of bone that was thought to be a collarbone of a human-like creature is actually part of a dolphin rib. But listen to this. He says the problem with a lot of anthropologists today is that they so much want to find a hominid that any scrap of bone becomes a hominid bone. And this is true. Hominids have been claimed from fragments of fossils, not only from pigs and dolphins, but also alligators, horse, bear, elephants, and donkeys have all been at one point claimed to be hominids in an attempt to prove human evolution. Nigel Locks is a science correspondent and health editor for the Times newspaper in London. He says few sciences produce such abundant returns from so few fragments of facts as paleontology. And this is true. Paleoanthropology in particular. In 1911, Piltdown Man was discovered. This is actually a staged photo of the gravel pits in Piltdown, England, where Charles Dawson found Piltdown Man. Otherwise, I don't think you dig for fossils in dress shirts and vests, so I'm pretty sure that's a staged photo. Piltdown Man, in 1912, it was announced that Darwin's missing link had been found. It was published under the New York Times headline, Darwin's Theory Proved True. The discovery Piltdown Man reigned supreme in classrooms and in universities across the globe. Scores of books and pamphlets, articles were written about Piltdown Man. And it took 40 years. 40 years later, it was finally revealed that it was a fraud. 40 years later. It turned out that the jawbone that they found, the teeth on it had been filed down to make them look more human-like, and the bones had been treated with chemicals to give them the appearance of age. Once full testing was done, once this was revealed, it is said that the file marks on the teeth were so obvious that they had to have been intentionally overlooked by people who would use this as evidence. But it's not fossils, bones or even pig's teeth that have convinced so many people of human evolution, but this is actually probably one of the most convincing pieces of evidence that exists as far as human evolution is concerned. But it's not fossils, it's a mere propaganda. This diagram is arguably one of the most recognizable scientific illustrations of all time. It became known as the March of Progress. This diagram was published in a Time Life book series called Early Man. This particular poster, when pulled out, formed a 5-page-long poster that was mailed out independently of the book series as a promotional tour, mailed to schools, libraries across the globe. As a result, this poster ended up in classrooms everywhere and probably convinced more people that human evolution must be true than anything else, a diagram such as this. Even Stephen Jay Gould, one of the most popular evolutionists of our day, stated that the March of Progress is a canonical representation of evolution, he said. It's the one picture immediately grasped and viscerally understood by all, the March of Progress. The diagram has been reproduced countless times, parodied countless times. The problem with the diagram, it was knowingly fictitious. The author states that the proto-apes and apes shown here were actually quadrupedal, but all are shown here standing for comparison. It was known that the apes shown here and the proto-apes shown here, the theoretical proto-apes, were all quadrupeds. And he says they're shown standing for comparison, but note they're not just shown standing, they're shown walking. That's why it became known as the March of Progress. The fact is, there is a significant difference between humans and apes. Significant difference between, and most of these differences are morphological, structural differences that are related to the ways that apes and humans walk or stand. Apes being quadrupeds, they're what we call knuckle walkers. When they walk on the ground, their wrists lock into place and they walk along on their knuckles. Humans walk upright, and there's a number of significant anatomical differences that humans possess that are specifically related to the upright posture, the bipedal method of movement that humans possess. The differences are significant. Taxonomically, there are two groups of ape men, or two groups that these supposed intermediate forms fall into. You got the genus Australopithecus. These are collectively known as Australopithecines, Australopithecus afarensis, Australopithecus africanus. There are several in here, all known collectively as Australopithecines. The creation science community almost uniformly regards these as true apes, as just apes, the Australopithecines. And we're going to look at these. The other genus, the genus Homo, includes Homo erectus, Neanderthals, and obviously Homo sapiens. I have intentionally overlapped Homo habilis there in the center because most of your creation scientists regard Homo habilis as a mixture of ape fossils and human fossils, okay? But all of your ape man can be classified as having been created in one of three ways. One of three ways. This is how you make an ape man. One, the way they created Homo habilis, you combine ape fossils with human fossils and then declare the two to be one individual. He's a real ape man. Another way is that you emphasize human-like qualities of fossilized apes. And with some creative imagination, you could upgrade these apes to look more human-like, especially in diagrams and models, these kind of things. The other, you can emphasize ape-like qualities of fossilized humans. And again, with some creative imagination, you can downgrade your humans to be more ape-like. All of these ape men can be classified as coming into being in one of these three ways. So I'm going to look at several of these. We want to look at Australopithecines. We then want to come back and look at Neanderthals and Homo erectus and try to give you, to help you interpret these findings again from the biblical worldview. Australopithecines. The poster child of Australopithecines is Lucy. The first discovered Australopithecus afarensis was discovered in Ethiopia by Donald Johansson in 1974. Said to be 40% complete, but I really haven't looked that up to see how they came up with that number, because you don't have 40% of the bones there for sure. Dated to be about 3 million years old, claimed to be a biped. You can see reconstructions of Australopithecus afarensis in museums across the globe. Here's one from the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. Here's another from the Maxwell Museum of Anthropology at the University of New Mexico. Lucy, the actual Lucy discovery, the fossils of Lucy were actually toured through Seattle back in 2009 at the Pacific Science Center. Anyone go see Lucy when she was here? A couple of people. I took my creation apologetics class. There's me in the back. I teach not only high school level sciences, but I also offer a class on creation apologetics at Cedar Park, one of Cedar Park's campuses. But I took my class here to see Lucy, and there were a couple of important observations that I made, but the one that I will mention is that the Ethiopian government, in order for them to allow Lucy to be toured through the U.S., the Ethiopian government required that they also include within the exhibit the history of Ethiopia, which ended up being almost entirely the Christian history of Ethiopia. And these huge churches that they have completely carved out of stone, the whole church carved completely out of stone. But I thought that was just so cool. In this evolution exhibit, right there smack dab in the middle of it, the Christian heritage of Ethiopia right there in the middle. I thought it was pretty cool. Here's another one. This one's at the Living World exhibit at the St. Louis Zoo. But I want you to notice something here. Not only in the original Lucy were no hands and feet found, but at all of these exhibits, they have very human-like hands and feet. Look at the feet shown here. A little better look at them here. Fingers and toes are straight. Hands and feet are clearly human-like. Even a very pensive gaze on his face as he's pondering, will she say yes if I ask her to prom? I don't know what she's thinking there, maybe. But the problem with this, when they created this exhibit, when this model was created, it was already known at this time they had found other fossils, had found most of the hands and feet of Lucy, and it was already known by the time this exhibit was created that Lucy did not have human-like hands and feet. One of the most substantial research efforts was done by Jay Stern and R. Sussman in 1983, and they revealed that they had very ape-like, heavily muscled and curved hands and feet, those that are similar to apes. Stern and Sussman says that a summary of the Hadar hand fossils leads inexorably, they say, to an image of a suspensory adapted hand, one designed for hanging in trees, what we call brachiation. Suspensory adapted hands, surprisingly similar, they said, to the hands found in the small end of the pygmy chimpanzee to common chimpanzee range. So they're even more similar to pygmy chimpanzees than regular chimpanzees. They continue. They said there is no evidence that any living extant or living primate has long, heavily curved, heavily muscled hands and feet for any purpose other than to meet the demands of full or part-time arboreal life, living in the trees. They have the hands and feet of an ape that lives in the trees, not one that walks upright on 2 feet. The shoulder blades are also the same kind of shoulder blades we find in apes that live in the trees. Shown here, the shoulder socket of afarensis is sharply angled. Humans are more vertically oriented. In an article published in 2000, the article titled Lucy on the Ground with Knuckles, I'd give you a little bit of trivia. Lucy was apparently named because the night after its discovery, they were playing the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds in the camp, and someone decided that that was a good name for Lucy, so the article. Anyway, it published both in Nature and Science News. They say that Australopithecus animensis and afarensis, the latter represented by the famous skeleton known as Lucy, has wrists capable of locking the hands in place during knuckle walking. They had hands similar to those that are designed for arboreal life, and when they're on the ground and walking, their wrists lock into place like all other knuckle walking apes. Their hip was also very, very ape-like. The iliac blades of humans go front to back, whereas in apes, they flare out laterally. The similarity of Lucy's, the Australopithecus afarensis hip bones, the iliac blade in particular, to the apes is very, very striking. And Stern and Sussman regard this as well. Now, they believe that it was an intermediate, that it was a human ancestor, but they nevertheless pointed out a number of problems with it. They summarize the fact that the anterior portion of the iliac blade faces laterally in humans but not in chimpanzees is obvious. The mark's resemblance to Lucy is equally obvious, they say. It suggests to us that the mechanism of lateral pelvic balance during bipedalism was closer to apes than than to humans. That's their conclusion. So you have an ape that you want to be an ape man to lead to humans eventually, but all the fossils that you have don't look like they would walk upright. They're definitely knuckle walkers. The hip, the iliac blade is that of a quadrupedal ape. So what can you do if you have a fossil that won't walk upright? Well, you can hack it up, and then by doing a little bit of reconstructive surgery on it, you could get you an ape that walks upright. This is one thing you could do. And if it seems like I'm being facetious, I'm not, because this is exactly what they do. Reported in this PBS Nova series in 1994, Dr. Owen Lovejoy sees the position of the iliac blade as being problematic, assumes that the bones must have been broken and reformed back together so that they look more ape-like. Watch this.
The ape that stood up, it was a revolutionary idea. We needed Owen Lovejoy's expertise again, because the evidence wasn't quite adding up. The knee looked human, but the shape of her hip didn't. Superficially, her hip resembled a chimpanzee's, which meant that Lucy couldn't possibly have walked like a modern human. But Lovejoy noticed something odd about the way the bones had been fossilized.
When I put the two parts of the pelvis together that we had, this part of the pelvis has pressed so hard and so completely into this one that it caused it to be broken into a series of individual pieces which were then fused together.
I believe it was broken. So he decides to correct what he considers to be a misshapen pelvic bone. Watch this.
This has caused the two bones, in fact, to fit together so well that they're in an anatomically impossible position.
The perfect fit was an illusion that made Lucy's hip bone seem to flare out like a chimp's.
It's just an illusion.
But all was not lost.
Fix that. Mm-hmm.
Lovejoy decided he could restore the pelvis to its natural shape. He didn't want to tamper with the original, so he made a copy in plaster. He cut the damaged pieces out and put them back together the way they were before Lucy died. It was a tricky job, but after taking the kink out of the pelvis, it all fit together perfectly, like a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle. As a result, the angle of the hip looks nothing like a chimp's, but a lot like ours.
These are the models we see. These are the models we see, not actual models, but modified models. This is important to remember. Lucy also had an ape-like face. They had the face of what's called a shovel face. One of the big differences between humans and apes is that humans have a very flat face. Apes have this shovel face. Other significant differences with the skull. The point of attachment of the spinal cord to the skull was more similar to that in apes than in humans. They also had the inner ear. Humans have a much finer inner ear. The semicircular canals in the inner ear that are regarding balance are much finer in humans than in apes because of the bipedalism. They had an inner ear. The inner ear bones are much more similar to humans. The place on the skull where the ear canal exists is more similar to apes than in skulls. And a number of researchers have mentioned this going back decades. That was the one first evidence that people just started really clamoring about, was the fact that the skull was overwhelmingly ape-like. And a number of researchers, again, going back for decades. Ashley Montague is a British-American anthropologist who taught at Harvard, Princeton, Rutgers, University of California, and New York University. He says, the skull form of the Australopithecines is extremely ape-like. He says the Australopithecines show too many specialized and ape-like characteristics to either be the direct ancestor man or even of the line that led to man. Lord Zuckerman is a professor of anatomy at Birmingham University in England and is the chief scientific advisor to the British government. He said, I find myself totally unpersuaded. Almost always when I've tried to check the anatomical claims of which the status of Australopithecus is based, I have ended in failure. He said, the Australopithecine skull is in fact so overwhelmingly simian as opposed to human that the contrary proposition could be equated to an assertion that black is white. I mean, that's a pretty stern statement. So you have a skull that's very simian, very ape-like, but you want it to look more human-like. So with some creative imagination and some artistic licensing, you can end up making a diagram that looks more human-like, and that's what they do. There's several, this model was modified significantly to make it more human-like, including the whites of the eyes. No apes have whites in their eyes. But the person that made this reconstruction for National Geographic in 1996 even admits this. He says, I wanted to get a human soul into this ape-like face to indicate something about where she was headed. It's not an exact reproduction. It's not an accurate model. They know that. He says that. But he wanted to get a human-like, a human soul into the ape-like face. This is how the public is misled. They think that what they're seeing is factual, is actual, but it is not. It is distorted to support a particular worldview, the view that we have evolved from apes. The difference between Australopithecines and humans are significant, very significant. Not only cranial capacity, but all structurally, the bones that are required for bipedalism are all unique to humans and distinct from apes. Charles Oxnard is arguably the world's foremost expert on the computerized analysis of bones using X-ray 3D technologies. He concludes, the Australopithecine says, are now irrevocably removed from a place in the evolution of human bipedalism, possibly from a place in a group any closer to humans than African apes, and certainly from any place in the direct human lineage. He says irrevocably removed, but I think he's a little naive, because evolutionists will never disavow a particular evidence until something else is there to take its place. Until they have another contender to replace the Australopithecines, afarensis will remain as the first, the main ancestor to humans. So let's look at some others. Let's look at Neanderthals and Homo erectus and how these should be viewed as from the biblical worldview. Neanderthals were first discovered in the Neander Valley near Dusseldorf, Germany in 1856. Original reconstructions of Neanderthal had them looking very ape-like. Very, very ape-like. This is one of the very first drawings that was done in Neanderthal man. They lived throughout much of Europe, part of Asia. This green zone shows you where they have found Neanderthal fossils. They lived just south of what's called the 50th parallel north, which is where the glaciers advanced to during the Ice Age. Creation scientists believe that the Ice Age was formed by the global flood. During the recession of the global flood, you had this massive Ice Age form, and this is where the ice advanced to. So they lived just south of these glaciers during the Ice Age. There are some distinctions between them and what we would call modern Homo sapiens. In particular, they got a thick brow ridge, very heavy, thick brow ridge. But the most significant difference, I guess, other than that, is that they had what we call robust bones. Very thick bones. The difference between the Neanderthals and your Homo erectus and what we would call modern Homo sapien bones is that the modern Homo sapien bones are graceful. They're thin in comparison. Robust bones versus very graceful or thin bones in modern Homo sapiens. They were also kind of stocky body builds, short extremities, big game hunters. We found them buried with mammoth tusks and these kind of things. Look at how they're modeled, though, today. Far from that diagram that I showed you initially. This is from the Neanderthal Museum in Mettmann, Germany. This is how Neanderthals are modeled today. Most anthropologists now acknowledge that Neanderthals were fully human. As far back as 1978, Eric Tinkus, who's an anthropologist at Washington University, said that a detailed comparison of Neanderthal skeleton remains with those of modern humans have shown that there is nothing in Neanderthal anatomy that conclusively indicates that they have locomotor, manipulative, intellectual, or linguistic abilities inferior to those of modern humans. Vizodera has written 3 books on surgery, on surgical books on human anatomy. He said, despite their stocky body build and their stocky skull shape, there is no hard evidence to say that Neanderthals were in any way inferior intellectually to modern man. They are known to have made sophisticated flint tools, built huts out of animal skins, and had control of fire. They also buried their dead. The fact that they buried their dead is taken to be very significant. Burial is seen to be a very human-like behavior and a very religious behavior. Marvin Lubinow, who published the book, wrote the book Bones of Contention. If I was to suggest any one book on the whole ape man view here, it would be Marvin Lubinow's Bones of Contention. He gives a really thorough analysis of Neanderthals, Homo erectus. They may have it out there in the back. Very, very significant book. But in the Journal of Creation, Marvin Lubinow summarizes that the human burials, he says, most anthropologists recognize burial as a very human and very religious act, but he said the strongest evidence that Neanderthals were fully human and of our own species is that at 4 sites, Neanderthals and modern humans were found buried together. So they found humans and Neanderthals found buried together. Actually, they have found modern humans predating all Neanderthals and Homo erectus and contemporary with almost all Australopithecines. They have found what we would consider modern Homo sapiens, the gracile bones of modern Homo sapiens, predating all Neanderthals, predating all Homo erectus. And it's a problem that they find these fossils. They keep having to revise their theories. Oh, modern Homo sapiens must have evolved earlier than previously thought because we keep finding them over and over again. Another look at Neanderthals. This, again, is from the Neanderthal Museum in Mettmann, Germany. Again, big game hunters. We find them buried with trophies like mammoth tusks and these kind of things, with jewelry, lots of cave paintings. They have uncovered a ton of sophisticated cave paintings. Or look at this one. This is the famous Gibraltar child. Reconstruction, the famous Gibraltar child. They were fully human. This is now widely regarded. Original reconstructions are known to have been terribly wrong. They are now viewed to be very human-like. 100% human. Brain capacity is even slightly larger than ours. They used jewelry, used musical instruments, cave paintings, buried their dead. Everything we know about the Neanderthals would argue that they were fully human. But you can see rearranged data for Neanderthals too, especially older data. Jack Kowozo's book, Buried Alive, focuses more on Neanderthals. Jack Kowozo was a retired orthodontist who managed to get access to actual Neanderthal skulls at the museums over in France and Germany. His credentials as a retired as a physician, and he went there with a portable X-ray machine. And so he was able to get these skulls and literally X-ray them at the museums where these things were housed, which is, I mean, that's just incredible that they would actually give you access to them. Because today, to get access to one, you have to have one. You know, a little quid pro quo kind of thing. You have to be a fossil hunter to get access to fossils. You have to be a paleoanthropologist to be able to examine these kind of fossils. But he was able to. Nonetheless, while he was there, he found this diagram at the souvenir counter at one of the museums in Berlin, which gave a very ape-like appearance to Neanderthals. And he noticed that they had given this ape-like appearance to this diagram by moving the jaw forward. He, as a retired orthodontist, he could tell right away the jaw was out of socket. The fossa, the point where the jaw hinges in, is right there. This jaw is moved forward by a full 30 millimeters. And by doing that, they make them look more ape-like. Because remember, one of the big differences, humans have a very flat face, but apes have that shovel face. But what they tend to find for these older human fossils is the jawbone and the skull cap. That's it. The skull cap, very, very thick. The jaw as well, very, very heavy, boned. And they would tend to just find those too. But no indication of really where the jaw was in relation to the skull, because all they have is the skull cap. And he said he's even seen paleoanthropologists looking at the skull cap and the jaw. Okay, does it go there? Does it go there? If it's here, it's more human-like. If we pull it out here, it looks more ape-like. And they kind of rest on those. I found this one. But this is, again, an actual Neanderthal diagram. And you can see the difference now. See the very flat face when the jaw is put back in place? This is an actual Neanderthal diagram. But the difference between this one and the one that Jack Quills saw. I found this one actually on Wikipedia, a Homo erectus, but the exact same thing. The jaw is completely out of socket. Move forward to give it more of that shovel face to emphasize ape-like qualities of fossilized humans. Because most creation scientists, not all, there's actually one book, he argues a slightly different point, but in almost universally, the creation science community regards both Neanderthals and Homo erectus as humans. So let me look at Homo erectus just briefly for you as well. The first discovery of a Homo erectus was this one called Java Man. But again, gives it a very ape-like face. This is one of the original diagrams dating all the way back to the 1922. These diagrams are. But all they found was a skull cap. This was the first discovery of Java Man found near Java Islands in, around Indonesia. But he found a skull cap and a femur and a single tooth. But there were debates from the very beginning about whether or not the femur belonged to the skull cap, because the skull cap was very robust and the femur was more graceful, similar to modern humans. So there was argument from the very beginning about whether or not the two belonged together, and they were found at different times and a significant difference distance apart. But today, most people believe that the skull cap was itself from what we today call a Homo erectus. The next discovery was from Peking Man, also in the 1920s. This is actually the entrance to the cave system where Peking Man was discovered. Near Beijing, which was originally called Peking, or that's how we pronunciated it. Look at another picture of the statue that's out front, which kind of cracks me up a little bit, because I have to imagine what that poor guy would have thought that lived in that cave had he came back and saw that monument sitting out front of his cave. He said, dude, they were worshiping me like I was a god, you know? I mean, what would that poor guy have thought to come back and see that big statue there, you know? Well, what they found in this cave system were six skull caps. A total of six skull caps were found. Others were done later in later excavations. But I've heard this particular discovery criticized for the very reason that they were all lost. All of these skull caps were lost. During World War II, interesting story behind it all. You can look it up. But they... when Japan was invading during World War II, they decided they needed to move them to a safe location. And they gave them to some American servicemen who, while transporting them down to a shipping area, something happened. The servicemen ended up in an internment camp, and the skull caps gone. They don't know what happened to them. And even as early as recently as 2005, the Chinese government was trying to inspire some interest in them to see if they could figure out what had happened to them in the beginning. Nonetheless, a number of discoveries have been made since. Just want to give you some of the history behind this. This is a map that shows where the Homo erectus fossils have been found. All the red points point to locations where they believe they have found Homo erectus remains. And very similar to Neanderthals in a lot of ways, smaller, but very similar. One of the main distinguishing characteristics, again, a heavy brow ridge. But you can find brow ridges in people today. So the fact they have a brow ridge, not necessarily significant. They also had a very flattened forehead, didn't have much of a pronounced forehead, also didn't have much of a chin, and they had a large bun, what they call a bun, on the back of the skull. So the different shapes, but otherwise the cranial capacity a little smaller than modern Homo sapiens. Neanderthals were a little larger. Cranial capacity, the skull size, but in Homo erectus a little bit smaller. Otherwise, very similar to Neanderthals, just a slight difference in size. And in fact, many researchers believe they are the same. And it was questioned for a great length of time whether or not we could actually identify modern Homo sapiens skulls from Homo erectus just on the size of cranial capacity, for example. The size of the skull was seen to be very significant in Homo erectus. But a study had never been done until very recently when researchers actually tested the cranial capacity of several different modern Homo sapien races and compared those with Homo erectus and found that there was significant overlap. They concluded that now, they said that comparable data is available. It appears that if Homo sapiens include all the people alive today in the world, their ancestors in the late Pleistocene, and those that we call the archaic Homo sapiens, like Dolly and however that's pronunciated, then vault thickness alone cannot be used to distinguish Homo erectus from Homo sapiens. So vault thickness, the actual thickness of the skull, cannot be used because there's such a variation. And as well, cranial capacity cannot be used. In 2008, this is a diagram by the National Science Foundation. In 2008, they found a pelvis, female pelvis of Homo erectus, that showed that at least at birth, if this could be taken as an indication of the size of the infant skull, then the cranial capacity is well within the range of modern humans. So very, very similar to modern humans in many respects. You got the thicker bones, but other than that, not much to say that we're distinct. They also had lots of tool use. This is probably just more trivia than anything else, but I found this to be interesting, and so I stick things in here that I find interesting, even if you guys don't, that's fine. But one of the most significant tools they found at Homo erectus sites was this thing called a hand axe. And the browned out areas here are the places where they specifically have found hand axes associated with Homo erectus sites. But and there's even a little monument of a hand axe at a park in England. Now, they're called hand axes because they're roughly the size of a hand. And as you can see here, they find them in all kinds of different shapes and sizes, but it's still debated today what they actually were used for. And one of the problems is that most of them, I mean, although it's about the size of a hand, if you were going to use it in your hand, you would round off one end. The end that your hand was going to hold would be nice and rounded off and smooth, but they're not. They're beveled all the way around. And so that's called them into question as to what they were actually used for. I've heard it argued that they were they might have been a left behind core when they were used of a stone that was being used to make arrowheads and things. You hit one stone with another, chipping off these fragments, and what would be left behind would be a core. So it's been argued that that might just be left behind cores. But it's also been argued that they might have been a projectile that was actually thrown at prey. And Marvin Lubinow, again in Bones of Contention, makes this argument. And I even found on another article them being called a super frisbee. Called them a super frisbee. But Marvin Lubinow argued that that the discus event might actually be traced all the way back to when these kind of stone implements were thrown at prey. So you catch them in a watering hole, you know, and you get several guys to toss these things at them. I don't know, more trivia than anything else. But let me try to give you the biblical perspective on these, in particular Homo erectus and Neanderthals. Who were these? Australopithecines, clearly apes, okay? But these appear to be humans, different from us, but humans. And so I wanted to make sure that you understand how we should interpret the Homo erectus and Neanderthals from the biblical worldview. Who were these people? When did they live? Why are they different? Okay, so kind of I'm going to have to go briefly on this, but give you enough to where I think you'll have something solid to stand on. In general, the creation science community regards the Homo erectus Neanderthals as post-flood humans. So people that had lived after the flood. And a number of researchers have, through comparison, argued that they are just one and the same. Just two slightly different sizes. Marvin Lubinow makes this conclusion. He says, my own conclusion is that Homo erectus and Neanderthals are actually the same. Homo erectus is on the lower end with regard to size of a continuum that includes Homo erectus and the early Homo sapiens and your Neanderthals. The range of cranial capacities for fossil humans is in line with the range of cranial capacities for modern humans. They're just the same. Peter Line, published in the Journal of Creation, makes a similar argument. He says, without the burden of having to fit fossils into an evolutionary scheme, there is no reason not to accept fossils such as those categorized as erectus and Neanderthals as belonging to the one humankind. No reason not to. And he says, if fossils such as those categorized as Homo erectus and Neanderthals were fully human, then the case for human evolution essentially collapses, as there is an unbridgeable morphological gap between the Australopithecine apes and humans. Correctly understood, as humans, the Neanderthals and Homo erectus, and Australopithecines as truly ape, we got this huge gap between the two. The missing link is still missing. The differences in skeletal anatomy, Peter Line argues for several factors that could have attributed to the difference in the skeletal form. And some, I think, more compelling than others, but he mentions greater genetic diversity, Back, the further you go into the past, the more genetic diversity there is within any given population. And in humans, that's almost certainly the case. They were living during, he says, they were living during particularly harsh environmental conditions, the post-flood ice age. That's a tough time to live in, tough time to make a living, to find food, you know, for who knows how long after the flood before they were able to start farming again, because they wouldn't have had any topsoil. It takes a long time for these very hardy, for you first to have very hardy plants that will come in, and after several generations of those, you'll have enough topsoil to allow for the farming of crops. Anyway, he also mentions dietary habits, nutrient deficiencies. It's been argued that some of them might have had rickets, which is, I think, a vitamin C deficiency. Can anyone correct me on that? I think it is vitamin D. So he mentions this. He also says possibly the stress of particular biomechanical forces can account for some of these thicker jaws and things. What he's referring to there is using like your teeth and for tools. So unknown to most people, your bones are constantly remodeled to better handle the stresses that are placed upon them. Your bones are constantly remodeled. The bones you have today are not the same bones you had 10 years ago. They're different. They're constantly remodeled. You have cells that eat away at bone, and then other cells that lay down new bone matrix constantly. And so you've heard like people that get real big, they'll say, "Oh, I'm not fat. I'm just big boned." You ever heard someone say that they're just big? Have you heard that? Well, it's true in a way. But I mean, when you get big, your bones get big to accommodate that, to help handle that additional stress. But they're not big because they're big boned. They're big boned because they're big. Okay, but it's true. Or look at someone's hands, for example, that's like your professional mount rock climbers. If you ever had a chance to look at hands of someone that's a professional at some sport like that, you'll see bone development that you don't see in normal people because to handle that stress. And what he's referring to here is the use of teeth, use of the jaws, for example, as a tool. You know, when you don't have a vice grip or a pair of pliers or those kind of things, you clean your teeth, you know. You're trying to make strips out of hide, you know. You're going to put the hide in your mouth and you're going to start pulling on that, you know. And that kind of stress placed upon those bones would cause your body to respond by thickening those bones, okay. So a probability. He mentions pathology, again, diseases caused by a variety of things. Even nutrient deficiencies cause pathology or diseases. But the most compelling to me is the last one, longevity. Most compelling here, longevity. Remember, before the flood, people lived to be 800-900 years old. And then after the flood, the lifespans of humans fell off, although fairly rapidly, it took many generations. You can see that I just created this graph just to plot out the ages that people recorded to have died at. And it appears, if I interpret it correctly, that one of the intended consequences of the flood was to reduce the human lifespan. If you go back and read Genesis 6, when God says, "I'm going to destroy the world by flood," first he says, "My soul will not contend with man forever, for he shall be 120 years. It says, man shall not be 120 years because I'm going to destroy the world by flood. Some people interpret that to mean the flood was going to happen 120 years from then, but that's not how I read it. And from biologically, it's very interesting or compelling that the maximum human lifespan is 120 years. Pretty much exactly. You look it up. You can't find any. I did some research on this a few years ago and found one woman that had been reported to be 121 when she died, but that was it. Could only find that one instance of anyone that recorded to have lived beyond 120. Moses died at exactly 120. The lifespans of these patriarchs fell off pretty rapidly down to 120. So consider what a person's bones look like. Remember that your bones are constantly being remodeled, constantly being built on as you progress through life. What would a person's bone look like that is 400 years old, 500 years old? The difference in these Homo erectus and Neanderthals could simply be due to the fact that what you're looking at are these peoples that are after the flood that were still living to be several centuries old. It's a compelling argument. Let me have you look at something else too, the changing theories through time, I think can help you understand this picture and why things are taught one way and then things change later. Look at this diagram by Bill Merlert in the Journal of Creation. He Notice the differences between how Neanderthal and Homo erectus have been viewed over the last few decades. Okay, back in 1955, Australopithecines, down here on the bottom, are thought to have evolved into Homo erectus, and then Neanderthals and Homo sapiens were believed to both have evolved from Homo erectus, but were not related to each other. Okay, 1967, Australopithecines, Homo erectus evolved into Neanderthals, the Neanderthals evolved into Homo sapiens. Okay, 1971, again, Australopithecines, then they would insert Homo habilis here, which we think is just a mixture of ape, and then Homo erectus and Neanderthals and Homo sapiens have both evolved from Homo habilis, but are not related to each other at all. 1980, Australopithecines, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, and at this point, Neanderthals were considered the same species as Homo sapiens. It was a subspecies, Homo sapiens neanderthalis. It was considered a subspecies. But today, Neanderthals are considered to be completely distinct from modern humans, not related at all. Even though we know how human they were. You see the models that they're creating of these people, but they say they're not related to us at all. Yeah, but let me show you one of the kind of puzzling things about this, how they have viewed Homo erectus in the past versus how they view it now. There's been some changing theories here, and this is not a great diagram, but you're going to have to bear with me on this. Okay, so the general timeline for Homo erectus evolution. Homo erectus is believed to have evolved into modern Homo sapiens over a period of centuries. Homo erectus have evolved about 1 million years ago or earlier, and then over a long period of time eventually evolved into Homo sapiens about 100,000 years ago. Okay, the general timeline. Okay, but the original view was referred to as a multi-regional view, wherein Homo erectus evolved in Africa originally, then migrated to these various areas like Europe and Asia. Oceania is referring to Australia and the islands that surround it. So that general region, you find some Homo erectus in the islands around Australia too. But they were believed to have migrated out of Africa to these various regions, and then each of these various regions, they would have evolved into the Homo sapiens that live there now. We find Homo erectus in these areas where Homo sapiens currently live. It makes sense that these Homo erectus populations evolved into those Homo sapiens. Makes sense, right? Makes a lot of sense. But look at what they did recently. Recently, they come up with this out of Africa theory, where they say that Homo erectus evolved in Africa, migrated to these various areas, Europe, Asia, and then out there by Australia, but then none of these became Homo sapiens. Instead, Homo sapiens evolved from the Homo erectus population that's in Africa, and that those Homo sapiens migrated into those areas. Weird, right? I mean, just weird that you would just suddenly terminate these Homo erectus populations and say, Marvin Lubinow argued in Bones of Contention that much of the justification for this was due to the attempt by some evolutionists to unshackle themselves from the racism that had been so common within evolutionary circles regarding humans, that some of these races of humans that we find, like the Australian Aborigines, were themselves less evolved races. If all of these have been evolving from Homo erectus at potentially different rates, then in one country you had more advanced Homo sapiens, or another country got less advanced Homo sapiens. And it led to some serious racism behaviors, even physically hunting Australian Aborigines and sending them back into museums in England, for example. They viewed them as lower human. You know? And so he argued that might have been the justification for it. But the out-of-Africa theory has been significantly bolstered by what you call mitochondrial Eve, mitochondrial DNA studies. You might have heard of mitochondrial Eve. I didn't put a graphic up there. I might have helped you with some popular media front page articles. But what they have discovered by testing... So I don't know how much detail to actually give you on this. Most of your DNA is in the nucleus of your cells, but you also have some DNA in the organelles that are on mitochondria, which is one of the organelles. There's also some DNA in chloroplasts in plants. They need lots of proteins, and so they just keep their DNA right there in the mitochondria. But during a reproduction, the baby gets almost all of its mitochondria from the mom. So mitochondria DNA is transferred from the mother continuously, None of the fathers is added to that. And there's no genetic recombination that takes place between in that DNA, like there is in the DNA that's in the nucleus. Nonetheless, what they've done is they've checked mitochondrial DNA from populations around the world, and that mitochondrial DNA has revealed a migration that has taken place, a sharp bottleneck that at some point the humans that are on the Earth apparently experienced a serious bottleneck because they have identified three separate mitochondrial lineages. Three separate women mitochondrial lineages have been discovered through this study, and from these three women, apparently they migrated across the globe. Now, they do this by checking mutations that are in the mitochondrial DNA. So in this population, they find a couple of mutations that are also in this population, but they have those two and a couple more. And then another population over here, they see all those mutations, but a couple more. And so by checking this mitochondrial DNA, they revealed to us this migratory path, which I think is very compelling, especially when you consider biblical history. Those three mitochondrial lineages, Noah's sons, three wives, right there. From all females on earth today have come from those three women. But, okay, look at this map. Okay, now what this is overlaid the Neanderthal and Homo erectus ranges, okay? I don't know how well you can see the difference between these two shades of yellow here, but it's the Homo erectus are down south side here, and then the Neanderthals are all up in here, okay? Now, if this, what we're looking at, now this is a diagram that I just got off the web from, that was some, you know, so, but interpreted from the biblical worldview, okay? If the Neanderthals and Homo erectus are who we think they are, these are just people that lived after the flood, still living to be several hundreds of years old, okay? Look at the location of the mountains of Ararat, where the ark would have come to rest. That's the location of the mountains of Ararat, and where the people would have migrated from that particular event, okay? But I want to show you the location of the Tower of Babel as well. Look at this significant branch point right here, and I'm going to show you where the Tower of Babel is believed to be located in northeastern Syria, in what is called the Upper Khabar River Triangle. The Tower of Babel is believed to be right here. Pretty much dead on right there. I mean, isn't that cool? Yeah, it's cool when you see, again, we must interpret scientific findings ourselves. But when we do that, we can see that there is, you know, significant consistency with the biblical history, right? What we see revealed to us is the history of mankind following the global flood, the dispersion that was initiated by God to trigger, after the Tower of Babel, then boom, you finally, for the first time, had these human populations shoot across. And it occurred to me after I created this slide that if God had not done this, humans would never have made it to North America until very recently. Because they made it to North America by bridges that only existed during the Ice Age. So if God hadn't kicked them into gear right here and told you to go and fill the earth, you know, get out of there, they wouldn't have been able to make it into these areas. Australia was accessible by land bridges. During the Ice Age, the ocean levels were lower because there was so much of it was up in the ice. So not only were there land bridges where you now have archipelagos, these island chains called archipelagos were once a long land bridge, and they were able to migrate, animals were able to migrate, and humans directly down into Australia, all across the Bering Strait over in North America, but they never have been in these areas had they not migrated then. If they waited any longer, the Ice Age would have melting off, these land bridges would have submerged underwater. Very interesting. So, but very cool to see this. You know, the consistency with the Bible. Three mitochondrial lineages pointing to three Noah's sons, three wives. The fact that the migratory routes match so well with the location of the Tower of Babel. Very cool stuff. You know, so again, trust in the Bible. You know, we can trust in the Bible as authoritative. Another example of the march of progress right there. You start looking for the diagram now, you'll see it everywhere. March of progress. The most famous, you know, scientific illustration of our time, without question. But I encourage you, trust in the Bible as authoritative. Allow it to inform you as to how to interpret scientific findings. Because remember that what scientists are doing today is they're trying to make sense of the world. You know, they're not stupid. They're incredibly intelligent, But they're just trying to interpret the world through a different worldview. Evidence is interpreted. And, you know, just like when you go in courtrooms every day, you have two different teams of attorneys that are interpreting the exact same physical evidence but interpret it completely differently. And that's just what's happening today. What is happening is a trial in the court of public opinion, as you have two sides, two different sides, trying to convince people that their interpretation of physical evidence is correct. But correctly understood, informed by the biblical worldview, informed by biblical history, we make sense of the world. And we stand alone, understanding the true history of the world, that fossils are the result of the global flood. That is a significant, significant piece of information. A person will never understand the history of the world if they don't correctly understand fossils. And correctly understood, we see a completely different story of humanity as well. It's very interesting. Let me close this in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you so much, again, that we have your word. How lost we would be without it, Father, having nothing to guide us but the teachings of man.